This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
We are in the lead up to the traditional kickoff to summer. It's going to be a week we all want to get through as fast as possible and get to Memorial Day weekend. Let's begin. It's This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Chris Quinn here with our cast of regulars, my colleagues Jane Cahoon, Layla Atassi, Laura Johnston. I know you're all raring to get to Friday.
3-day weekend. Sure. Here we come.
Well, I'll help you get there. Let's go. What's the potential loss to the Ohio economy from Governor Mike DeWine's decision to block the extra $300 a week that the federal government was providing for unemployment? Jane Cahoon, we wondered what this would suck out of our economy, and now we have a pretty good answer.
Yeah, we did some pretty simple math. Pete Krause, with the help of Rich Exner, calculated the amount of money that Ohio's foregoing. That begins June 26th, and the payments were supposed to go through September 4th. But by stopping them, you know, we're not going to get all this money. So they took the number of Ohioans who were receiving the $300 supplement, and then they multiplied that by 300, and then they multiplied that by the 10 weeks in the period. So that comes to just under $1 billion, which is a lot of money. Now, some experts say that money would be used for goods and services, necessities of life, and that would keep our economy going. So this is bad. One expert estimated that the impact would be even higher when you take into consideration, you know, the multiplier effect of spending triggering additional spending. He's saying more like $1.6 billion. But other experts, you know, I'd say mostly on the conservative side, say that ending these payments really could be a good thing for the economy if this does what it's designed to do, and that's to wean unemployed people off unemployment, get them back to work, and restart sectors of the economy that have been stalled by a lack of workers. So, you know, the big question, of course, is will taking this money away get people to go back to work? You know, people like Rob Portman have just been constantly beating the drum saying this money's a financial incentive for people to stay home, you know, rather than a lifeline. You know, so there's disagreement on this. That on the other side, a study by two San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank economists says that this really isn't much of an incentive to stay home. It factors very little in a person's decision to accept a job or not. You know, that more significant factors for taking a job are health and safety concerns, childcare issues, you know, the duration of the job being offered, and, you know, how many other opportunities exist. So, well, you know, from there, we could get into a huge debate about whether employers need to raise wages to get people to take these jobs. So we could go on and on.
Yeah, look, this is a political wedge issue. What we tried to do with this story was to put the political ideology aside. The idea that if people go back to work, you're putting more money into the economy doesn't take into consideration this $300 a week was coming from outside Ohio. So this was money that was being infused into the Ohio economy that's not. And studies throughout the pandemic showed that when people in need got extra cash, they did spend it. They didn't use it to pay off debt. They didn't use it to put it in savings accounts. They needed it. They spent it. And so that multiplier effect you mentioned was in full force. So it's worth way more than $1 billion, because when you go out and you buy goods and services, the people that are paid for those take that money and they spend it, and it continues to pump up the economy. The simple numbers show what Mike DeWine did is pulling a sizable chunk of cash out of the Ohio economy. And if we get to a point a year from now or 2 years from now where we're in recession, we'll have to look back and wonder, would this have been a hedge against it? Good work by Pete Krause, and thanks to Rich Exner for the assist. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What do legal experts think of First Energy's new strategy to claim that the $60 million it provided in the big bribery scheme was all legal and above board? Leila Tassi, this one had us scratching our heads last week. Reporter John Kiniglia went out and talked to a bunch of legal experts. They were scratching their heads too, but he put it all together, and what did he find?
Yeah, he did such a great job with this. What John points out in his story is that this came at such an unusual time in the case when First Energy had been quite clearly following the prescription for moving beyond a political scandal. They were firing people, dropping lobbyists, taking a closer look at how the company does its political giving and cooperating with investigators. And so some legal experts who John spoke with said that the inconsistency with First Energy's approach here is so glaring that it's insulting, particularly when we consider that the dark money nonprofit that collected the $60 million that First Energy claims was above board has already pleaded guilty to racketeering. It's abundantly clear that all parties involved knew the purpose of the money. But then other experts say that they appreciate the delicate balance that First Energy has to strike. They're in a really tough spot. They're being attacked on all fronts. They want to cooperate with the criminal case, but they also need to defend themselves in this lawsuit filed by investors. So, you know, honestly, after reading it all, I felt like that kind of made sense to me. I think as outrageous as First Energy's explanation seems, is there really any other way to play this? I mean, what do you expect a corporation to do under these circumstances?
Except that they're going to get rejected. I mean, the judges in the court system are not they're not ignorant of what's going on in the real world. And so when you stand before a judge and say, "Judge, this is all legal and above board donations," the judge is not a moron.
But else are you going to say?
Maybe you say we had some really bad actors in our company that did some things that were bad, and we should have had better checks and balances, but this is not indicative of the company culture, and you try and hemorrhage the bleeding. You're going to bleed. Yet you did. Your company cost these people a lot of money with its reckless and sleazy tactics to try and suck billions of dollars out of the pockets of unsuspecting Ohioans. You're going to pay for that.
Have they been so direct about bad actors to date? I mean, I don't think so, right?
They fired them.
But they put it on the record explaining what anyone has done?
They did file some documents in court that basically admitted to this questionable $4 million payment that was linked to Sam Randazzo, the former chairman of the PUCO. And they said that in one document that it was believed to have been done for the benefit of the company. You know, they basically admitted that this was sleazy in so many words. So yeah.
And meanwhile, they're negotiating to get out of the criminal charge with a big fine. So on the criminal side, they're going to have confessed to all of their sins. That will come into the civil case. So why not plan cohesively? Instead, they're being ridiculed. There were lawyers in John's story. I mean, you know, what did he say? If it quacks like a duck and it walks
A great quote.
I feel like they're very siloed. They're like, well, our public opinion stuff is going to do this, and our criminal trial is going to do this. And they're not thinking that we're all talking about them. This is the same company. You can't treat something in a legal court of law and expect what you're telling to, you know, your consumers not to crisscross.
But and the other thing that's going on here is this is not your normal company, right? This isn't Walmart, where if you think they're sleazy, you can walk away.
It's true.
Because of the utility system, we're forced to pay money to this sleazy company. So they have a responsibility to their ratepayers to be responsible. I still don't get this. This has to fail ultimately. The civil litigation will take longer than the criminal investigation. Everything will be on the table. And what they're arguing here is flat out preposterous.
Let me ask this question. So they call the First Energy is calling this money issue advocacy contributions. That sounds like a polite way of saying bribes. I mean, no, am I wrong?
Yes,
it is, right? So how are issue advocacy contributions legal? It sounds like we're splitting hairs. Does anyone know what is the difference? What is the difference between bribing?
Ask the legislature about this.
This is all the, you know, legalized legalize corruption, in my opinion, but it's the whole dark money system that's been set up. It is perfectly legal for people to contribute to these, you know, anonymously to these groups.
Not if it's part of a criminal enterprise. Not if
the contributions themselves, though, the way these things are set up, you know.
But if the company worked with Larry Householder in a deal where they'll provide $60 million so he can bribe his way into the passage of a bill that would suck money out of our pockets, then any action in that, no matter how legal independently, becomes illegal because it's part of a vast conspiracy. And there's enough people involved in this pleading guilty where the vast conspiracy is confirmed. So for them to file this pleading, it's just nonsense. And to say, well, they've got to do what they can to protect their bank account, it's not going to work. They're going down here. So it's time to negotiate just how much money they're going to have to pay the investors for secretly working against their interest. It boggles my mind that they filed this thing because it won't work. They're going to lose. And meantime, everything else they're doing seems to be admitting that they did bad things. Yes? No?
I don't disagree. I think Layla's point is what is legal is like a fine hair. And it's like what Jane said, dark money seems to just, I realize it's not pay to play, but it's about its special interests.
Well, and I also have never seen a lawyer throw their client under a bus like that. So I just expect the lawyer has to try. That, you know, right? The lawyers have to try.
Unless
so this is their way of doing it, using the polite term for bribery.
Unless you sit down and negotiate a settlement, because that's ultimately where you'll end up. Instead, you've brought great ridicule to your company once again, you know, not even a year after this whole scandal broke, and put your company into real jeopardy. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's the general consensus of Cleveland's major employers on bringing their workers back to the office? Laura Johnston, I think I'll actually make it back to the office now that I can answer our questionnaire that I don't have any of the symptoms of COVID. But what are other companies doing?
Many of them are coming back. And the idea is that the vaccine is out, people are healthy, and they have the ability to come back to the office. So the Downtown Cleveland Alliance says that they've had people working in their offices since last June on a rotating basis. And obviously their job is to make sure that downtown is vibrant. So they're all going to come back. And then Eric Heisig talked to a whole lot of companies, Sherwin-Williams, Chase, Key, that all have big presence in Downtown Cleveland. And they basically all said they are phasing back. And a lot of them said they're not going to require masks for employees who are vaccinated. So that's like a new step, obviously, with the CDC guidance. And K&D, which owns the Terminal Tower, the Halley Building, and Post Office Plaza, said that 50% of their office tenants have returned. They expect the rest back by July 1st. Obviously, they have an interest in keeping downtown full. But the report from the Downtown Cleveland Alliance said about 85% of office space was filled in the first quarter of 2021. Now, take that with a grain of salt, because we don't know how many people were locked into a lease at that time and what will change in the future.
You know, the thing that surprises me is that there's not a whole lot of what the employees want in the discussion. And we know from our own experience, our office opened up last week and we've had a trickle of people wander in there. People ultimately said, I think, Laura, you said it last week, you're getting ready to go. You realize there wouldn't be many people there. You had a lot of work to do and that would cost you precious time. So you decided not to. I think, Jane, you had a similar feeling on Thursday.
Yep.
With the shortage of people to fill jobs, with employers crying that they can't get enough workers, forget the whole wage issue, doesn't the employee wish to work from home become important?
Oh, I think absolutely. And there are some employers that are recognizing that. Highland Software, which obviously is not downtown, they're out in Westlake, said that in the past about 25% of employees worked remotely. They anticipate it's going to be 60% in the future. But yeah, this line, and Doug Price from K&D actually said, people are sick of working at home. They want to come back to the office. I don't think they're truly in touch with all of the people, because there are some people that really do like going downtown. And when it's 90 degrees tomorrow, I might be in the office.
Are they making it voluntary like we are, which is great?
I don't know about all of these companies. You know, obviously, this is not a public record. And so Eric just got to talk to a lot of spokespeople. So we're getting statements from these companies. We're not going into the office and being like, so do you really want to be here? Or do you wish you were throwing in your laundry while you were on this conference call?
Well, and Eric's story did point out the whole rent issue. I mean, yes. These companies, a big part of their expenses every year is their office space. And if they realize they could get by with a quarter of it and have a hybrid form where people come in one or two days a week, of course they're going to cut that expense because they want to have as high a profit as they can. This issue will not be resolved. I bet we won't be able to look back and figure out what happened for a couple of years.
But this is like this turning point, right? This is what we've been talking about for a couple of weeks now, where there is no reason that we have to just rush back to the return to normal and the status quo. This is where you take a breath and you say, what is best for my employees and my bottom line? And let's just think about it here.
Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is it possible that a level-headed Northeast Ohio Republican with no allegiance to Donald Trump might get into the race for U.S. Senate? Jen Cahoon, so far it's been a dance of the sycophants, one clown after another begging for his almighty's approval instead of talking about what the citizens of Ohio need. Are we going to see a change? Is there a possibility a candidate of substance who doesn't care about Donald Trump will step in?
Chris, you keep hoping and hoping and hoping. All we know is that State Senator Matt Dolan of Chagrin Falls, who's regarded as rather moderate, has launched an exploratory committee and is seeking donations that will help inform his decision about whether he's going to enter the U.S. Senate race, which, as you said, on the Republican side is dominated by candidates whose main focus is pledging allegiance to Trump. It's interesting, though, you know, if you go to the webpage that Dolan has launched, it's basically just his photo and a bunch of donation options that you can click on, and then one single quote from him, which I would say, you know, isn't really pro-Trump, but it's certainly a rather red meat appeal to the conservative base, not exactly an advertisement of Dolan's, you know, moderate credentials. It says, as Joe Biden and Democrats in Washington push America to the brink of socialism, open our borders, and attempt to rewrite the Constitution, I am concerned as an Ohioan about protecting our conservative values and fighting for what matters the most. I know serious problems require serious leadership. It's time to focus on what matters. So, you know, that to me says he's testing the waters to see if he's got some appeal to conservatives, perhaps the ones who don't have a big appetite for Trump. But as I said, he's not exactly promoting himself as a moderate on this. He's trying to go for that, you know, conservative vote that doesn't like Trump.
Yeah, forget the moderate. Just a Republican candidate who's talking about the needs of Ohio instead of begging for Donald Trump's approval. I mean, this has been one of the most depressing things you've ever seen, that these people are all raising their hand to run and just in adoration of a former president who pretty much tried to overthrow our government and likely is going to be charged with crimes before it's all over. Is he the candidate? I mean, there are a lot of Ohioans that are conservative, that have a conservative political bent. Can somebody stand up and say, look, forget Donald Trump. I don't care about Donald Trump. Donald Trump did what he did. We got to move on. We got to get back to the soul of the Republican Party. I'm your candidate. Would that work? Would that help him stand out from this kind of pathetic crowd that we've seen so far?
I think a lot of people would say, no, he doesn't have a chance. But, you know, who knows?
I don't know. Maybe he can team up with Anthony Gonzalez and storm the state, do a tour. Let's get back to the soul of the Republican Party. Ted Dyden could join him. He's in the same camp. It's like the party, if it does not move beyond Trump, is going to collapse.
You know, Ted, you definitely have to say he's conservative. So
yes, he's very conservative. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is the asphalt plant plan an opportunity corridor dying a fast death, particularly with the Planning Commission paving the way for a big food storage warehouse nearby? Leila Tassi, place where you store food and a place that puts out fumes from asphalt really don't mix together. The Planning Commission sees that, even if nobody else in City Hall does.
And that's right. This story gets more and more interesting by the day. So the Planning Commission late last week approved rezoning along the future opportunity corridor to accommodate this proposed cold storage facility designed to serve a cluster of food-related businesses nearby. And I assume that includes Orlando Baking Company and Maselli Dairy Products, which are established businesses there in the area. And that was all with Mayor Frank Jackson's backing. But even the members of the commission noted how this plan contrasts sharply with Jackson's other endorsed plan for that section of Opportunity Corridor, which is this construction trades training facility that would feature the smelly, dirty asphalt and concrete plant. I mean, that is, we've said it so many times on this podcast, that really it would be the death knell for all the opportunity on Opportunity Corridor. And so, Commission member Lillian Curry came out and said her vote in favor of the cold storage rezoning should be taken basically as a vote against the asphalt plant. By, you know, it seemed that she was saying that by locking in the cold storage facility, she hopes to be locking out this asphalt plant. And Councilman Charles Slife, who sits on the commission, said, "I want to put everybody on notice that this has to be a point of discussion, or else we just got the state to build a fancy road that nobody's going to want to locate on." And he said that as a former site selector who specialized in the food industry, he had serious concerns about placing an asphalt and concrete plant anywhere near food-related businesses. He said, "Concrete and asphalt create fumes. They create dust. The food industry is incredibly sensitive to all of those. We already have successful food processors in the immediate vicinity. We don't want to jeopardize that." That's pretty strongly opposed to this asphalt plant. And it really echoes what we heard from Council President Kevin Kelly and Councilman Blaine Griffin and Tony Brancatelli last week, that this plan is going to face heavy scrutiny for its potential to impact the future of Opportunity Corridor. So it sounds like, it's not going to be rubber stamped the way we all feared at the beginning. I think it's there's a long path ahead for this before it if it ever comes to fruition.
I think we can take some of the credit for this because we've been banging this drum since day one. Like, what are they thinking? It's a little surprising it took this long for other people to speak strongly, especially somebody like Tony Brancatelli. I did not know until I read Bob Higgs' story that he had successfully fought off an asphalt plant in his ward for all the same reasons, because it stinks. Right. He had a great quote in that story about, what did he say? It comes across as cute bunnies or something?
Yeah, like rainbows and unicorns. They try to pitch it to you like it's some beautiful thing that you're going to love. But, you know, when you look behind it, it's polluting, it's disgusting. And I think in that case, you know, so Bob Higgs is working on a follow to that, kind of exploring why that failed. But what he understands is that was proposed for an area really close to residential, and the residents were, they were not having it, so they killed it.
Yeah, in the end, I still would like to know at what point somebody greenlighted this and said, "Yeah, let's move forward." Because you would think the first time somebody said, "Hey, asphalt plant, Opportunity Corridor," whoever heard that pitch would go, "What are you thinking?" And instead, it was like, "Hey, great idea. Let's put that forward." And you're right. That did have the feeling for weeks it was going to get rubber stamped and move through, even though it's an atrociously bad idea. So it's good to see. And that now that you have the cold storage thing on the way or further along, it seems very unlikely. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is Breeze Airways the beginning of something good for Akron-Canton Airport, which has seen tough times since Cleveland Hopkins lured away a lot of airlines following the closing of the United Hub in Cleveland? Laura Johnston, I used to fly out of Akron-Canton when they had airlines there. It was so easy. You park out front, you go inside, but they've had so few airlines serving them. I don't remember the last time I was there. Is this the beginning of a turnaround, or is it just a one-time thing?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it depends. I think a lot of airlines are excited about paying for Hopkins' $2 billion renovation plan. But I'm with you. I used to go to CAK a lot back when they had AirTran, before it was part of Southwest and everything was at Cleveland. But this is Breeze Airline. It's basically a brand new budget vacation airline, originally known as Moxie, by the way. But because I know, Chris, you didn't love the name Breeze.
It just doesn't sound substantial to me.
It's starting from CAK this summer, three destinations, Tampa, New Orleans, and Charleston, South Carolina. And that starts June 26th. Prices are as low as $39 one way. And they hope to expand over the next couple of years. I believe 16 destinations on there. And they do think there could be some business travelers, although, I mean, if you look at Tampa, I guess there's business that goes on there. But from Cleveland, most of us just want to get somewhere warm in the winter.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they can attract others and whether it works. So the $39 price tag, I'm sure, would excite you if you were heading to Florida, because you said last week you look for low prices.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's we were talking, obviously, about the plan for Hopkins and what you want to pay. And, you know, it's one thing if you pay for a flight for yourself, right? It's not so different. But when you go to, you know, times four, or, you know, Layla's times five, it just gets a little more expensive. So budget definitely matters.
Okay, well, we wish them well. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Did Congressman Anthony Gonzalez say much that was interesting in the hour-long appearance he made at the City Club of Cleveland last week? Jane Cahoon, I caught part of this, and if I were answering the question, I think it would be a little bit different than yours.
I think I know. Let's face it, okay? A lot of it was really wonky and kind of heavy on policy, but you really have to admire him for that. He's really immersed in issues. He's very well-versed, and he articulates his position very effectively on various policy issues. But of course, everyone wanted to hear what he had to say about his impeachment vote and the attempt by his fellow Republicans to cancel him through censure and by running a pro-Trump candidate against him in next year's primary. So we did go into that territory here in this City Club forum. And he had a few interesting things to say about that. He said, you know, the Republican Party really needs to reevaluate its current standing in the federal government before it starts, you know, ostracizing and demonizing members of its own party who are not loyal to Trump. You know, he pointed out, hey, you know, they lost the both houses of Congress and the presidency, so they don't control any of the levers of powers. And he said, sometimes when I hear us talk about the state of the party, we talk as if we somehow won an election. So instead of, as I said, focusing on ostracizing people like him and Liz Cheney, he said, if we're going to win elections, you know, retaking the House and the Senate and the White House, there has to be room for, you know, both those who support Trump and those who don't. He said, if we're going to excommunicate people who feel differently than we do on one side or the other of that debate, it's a losing strategy. And we shouldn't be, as a party, committed to subtracting voters. You should be committed to adding voters. And he also stood by his impeachment vote. He said, and he noted that a lot of Republicans are continuing to perpetuate falsehoods, especially ones that are dangerous, that led to the violence on January 6th. And he said that's a recipe for disaster, and it's horribly irresponsible.
Well, and working against him, he says, you know, we didn't win any elections, but working against him is that Donald Trump and his followers has successfully convinced a sizable portion of the country that they did win the election, even though there's absolutely no evidence to back that up. The delusion is there. And so he is working against people who believe they actually won. It's tough days for the Republican Party when you have somebody like Anthony Gonzalez being targeted.
He seems to not care. Maybe I shouldn't phrase it that way, but he doesn't seem to be worried about the consequences here. I think he seems to be more worried about whether he can look himself in the mirror, you know?
Yeah, I know. He seems like a good guy. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Is Cleveland City Councilman Ken Johnson in complete denial about what he is facing? Is that why he is fighting to restore his position on the council? Well, Tassi, it's almost delusional what he's doing here.
Yes. All signs point to yes. I think he is in complete denial. So by way of background, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost sought Johnson's suspension following his indictment on 15 charges from a federal grand jury that, among other things, accused him of swindling the council out of $127,000 by submitting false expense reports. So then a panel appointed by the Ohio Chief Justice back in April agreed that the nature of the charges against Johnson make it really risky for him to continue serving on council. So they suspended him, even though he gets to keep his title and continues to receive his pay, which is nearly $87,000 a year. And late last week, Johnson filed a notice of his intent to appeal that decision. We don't really know what he's thinking right now because he has yet to file a brief, but we know he appeared before that panel before and argued for his innocence and said he expects to be acquitted of the charges when it goes to trial, which I think is this summer sometime. So we can reasonably predict that his appeal will make those same claims. And we know he took out nominating petitions to gather signatures that he needs to seek re-election. So, yeah, I'd say Ken Johnson is living in fantasy land right now. At least 16 other people in his ward have a clear view of his future because they have also pulled petitions to run for his seat.
What's surprising is that if he gets convicted of these charges, he will very likely spend most of the rest of his life in prison. He's not a young person, and these are charges that carry big prison time. You just wonder, you know, wouldn't you invest your energy in dealing with that instead of a Pyrrhic battle where you're, you know, trying to get back on a council where your term ends this year anyway?
Yeah, you would think so.
Like wasted time, wasted effort, that you just wonder if he's not, if he's not accepting the reality of what he faces.
Right. But this is a guy who's been on council since 1980. And I just, you know, it just, the whole thing just smacks of a sense of entitlement here, you know, that he just feels like he's going to push right past this and get right back to doing whatever he was doing before. So,
Yeah, that's not the way the federal prosecution system works.
We haven't noticed that.
Yeah, generally, they got you, and you end up making a deal to reduce the damage. Yep. If he goes to trial, then he very likely would spend the rest of his life in prison. Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Another Monday discussion in the books. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Laura. Thank you to everybody who listens to this podcast.